That's it isn't a matter of, you know, as I say, whens and ifs as to whether these things occur. It isn't a matter of if we get hit by one, it's only a matter of when. Look, so far what I've shown you is data, models and so on, which are based on hard science. I'm now going to show you some artists' impressions of these sorts of things and what they mean. Now, these are good artists' impressions because they're not drawn by a professional artist. They're actually painted by a professional astronomer whose name is Bill Hartman. Works in Tucson, Arizona. And he does these fantastic paintings which are very realistic. And so we can have confidence that they're close to being as things actually are. Now, this is a particularly interesting picture. It's supposed to show a spacecraft, and you can see three astronauts in space there, going out to inspect an Earth-crossing asteroid, try and investigate it, try and take away a bit of our ignorance as to what these things are like. There is another interesting thing in there, and some people in this audience, I know, will know what is peculiar about that painting. There is a joke by the artist in that painting. Don't shout it out, but I will tell you all when I show you this picture again in maybe 10 or 15 minutes. But there is a very specific joke by the artist in that painting. On to the next slide, please. Okay, look, here's another asteroid, and you can imagine you are somebody sat on it, and there's the surface underneath you, and in the distance is the Earth and then the Moon. Crescent Earth and crescent Moon in the distance, but they're not that far in the distance. In fact, they're getting closer very, very quickly, because this is supposed to be you sat on this asteroid an hour before it hits the Earth. Okay. Let's move on to the next slide. Here we are. Here's the Earth. This is 10 seconds before the impact. Everybody's merrily going about their business. There's cities around on the coastline in the lower right where ships are coming in and going out and going across the ocean. And everything's just hunky-dory and everybody's unsuspecting. And indeed, that is the most likely situation. If there was an asteroid due to hit the Earth tomorrow, almost certainly we wouldn't have seen it yet. In fact, we won't see it until about a second before it actually hits. And we'll see what it looks like a second before it actually hits in the next slide. There is the asteroid zapping through the atmosphere. And this is the only one of these paintings with which I have a differing of opinion. Actually, it is an opinion. Bill Hartman knows that this painting isn't right, but he couldn't think of any other way to do it. The point is that as an asteroid a few kilometers across zips through the atmosphere, the luminosity of the thing, the brightness of it, is greater than the brightness of the sun, to which extent you wouldn't get a shadow cast by the sun. Okay. There's the Moon up in the distance, which we all know is heavily pockmarked by these things hitting in the past, but this time it isn't the target, it's the Earth. That's 1 second before the impact. 30 kilometers per second is a typical impact velocity. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. You might think this was taken a second later. If it was a photograph, it isn't. That's actually 1 minute after the impact. Things move really slowly, you could say, in these impacts. Things, the stuff suddenly erupts, having punched a hole through the ocean and into the ocean floor underneath. The rock is thrown out in this huge cataclysm. In fact, the rock is thrown out and it will circuit around the Earth and re-enter all over the globe. And we know this happens. For example, we find the iridium from the time when the dinosaurs died and an asteroid hit the Earth. That iridium is found all the way around the globe, not just near the crater. We know where the crater is now. It was found 4 years ago. It's in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. It's a crater which initially was thought to be 180 kilometers across. We now know it's 400 kilometers across. That was again a huge explosion which occurred at the time at which the dinosaurs died. And the rock and the iridium from the actual impactor was thrown all the way around the Earth. In the same way as if you go outside and you see a satellite going over, it'll come over again about 90 minutes later, typically. And the same laws of celestial mechanics apply to the rock thrown out. They take 90 minutes to do a full orbit of the Earth. Well, 45 minutes later, this rock being thrown out will be landing at the exact antipodal point, to which extent it makes no difference if this impact happened to occur in North America or Europe. We've still had it here in Australia. This is a global effects impact. We're all in big trouble. We're all in this mess together, is what it comes down to. Right, that is a minute after the impact. Now let's step forward to a year after the impact in the next slide. What do we see? That's what we see. Not a whole lot. That rock which is thrown up We know circuits around the Earth. What happens is, in fact, it burns up as it enters the atmosphere. And in fact, when we look at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, the level in the geological strata when the dinosaurs died, we find that there is soot at that level, which its total mass is equivalent to greater than 90% of all the biomass on the Earth at the present, which means that all the lush, dense tropical rainforests were incinerated. First of all, they were desiccated or dried out by the fact that all this rock entering burns up in the atmosphere. So instead of it being like a meteor shower where you see 50 or 100 meteors per hour, the whole of the sky is lit up. It's like a gigantic griller with a temperature of 10,000 degrees up at an altitude of 80 or 90 kilometers. But that radiates downwards, and down here on the surface we know the temperature goes up to 1,000 degrees. What on earth survives such a thing? The answer is obviously the dinosaurs didn't, and you can ask yourselves whether you would survive such a thing as that. Now, we know that that happened. Okay, you'd never prove anything in science. You can never be 100% sure, but we know that that happened at the 99.999% level, and that's pretty damn sure. And we know that it's happened previously, and we know it will happen in the future if one is on the way with our number on it. Now, why is this thing all pinky brown? The answer is that a huge amount of dust is left in the atmosphere. If you make a crater 400 kilometers across, then you throw thousands of cubic kilometers of rock pulverized into the atmosphere. And if, in fact, you put rock above the stratosphere, it takes a long time to settle out. It can take 5 or 10 years to eventually settle to the surface. And while it's up there, it's reflecting away all the sunlight, so everything cools down. And in fact, it was from that recognition that the idea of nuclear winter came about. That is a winter, a global cooling caused by soot left in the atmosphere in the aftermath of a nuclear war. But the original idea was gained from consideration by astronomers of impacts. So this is what we could call a cosmic winter. So you've got this huge elevation in temperature initially, and then a gross cooling. It gets real cold until the soot settles out. And then what happens? The answer is that a huge amount of carbon dioxide has been left in the atmosphere by this impact, because usually you would hit carbonate rocks. In fact, where that impact was in Mexico is a carbonate rock region. And so all that carbon dioxide gets elevated, and we know what carbon dioxide does in the atmosphere. It causes a greenhouse effect. Then you've got an elevated temperature on the Earth, which goes on for something like 10,000 years, 100,000 years, according to best estimates. So you've got a very high temperature, and then a drop in temperature, and then the temperature goes up to be 20 or 30 degrees above the normal for a long period of time. So if you avoid being fried to death in the beginning, you freeze to death, and if you manage to survive that, then you get boiled to death again. So these things are bad news. There's no wonder that we've denied that they actually occur for so many years. If we move on to the next slide, we see what it all looks like 1,000 years later. Eventually the dust settles out. Eventually we see a bit of green as the plants start to grow again, because of course some seeds will survive. And I guess eventually various animals will start proliferating again. The dinosaurs would have gone, but the mammals were bursting through, and that is not a unique event in Earth history. That sort of thing has occurred many, many times before, and it can occur again in the future. Now, the reason that this is all basically in the public eye is due to this idea that dinosaurs being wiped out by an asteroid, and it really is in the public eye. And a way you can tell that people all know about it is that cartoonists can draw cartoons like this. Here's a father with his son in the Natural History Museum. This cartoon was actually taken from the New Yorker, and he's considering buying some models of dinosaurs, and the salesman says, "Take all six and I'll throw in the giant asteroid." Now, you all understand it because you all know what the scenario is which they're talking about, and it shows you that you've actually got it into your heads about the dinosaurs dying. But what you haven't got into your heads yet is that it can also apply to us. And that's a difficult thing to make a humorous cartoon about, but I'll show you a few in just a minute. Okay, where are these holes in the ground then? Well, they're all over the place is the answer, but they are concentrated in certain regions, at least the ones we know. There's a map of the world showing these holes in the ground, the craters. There's one over here in Mexico, you can see, one little blip there. That's the one which did off the dinosaurs, as far as we know. In fact, we believe there are many impacts at the same time, but that's the biggest one that has been identified so far. You can also see there are a lot of craters in Australia. There are 19 known impact craters in Australia. You also notice that most of the rest are either in Europe or in North America. Now, that isn't a random distribution, and it isn't even the real distribution of craters. The reason that we know of this distribution is, first of all, people have actually looked for them. Now, I hate to tell you this, but the people who have been finding them in Australia are not Australians. To a large extent, over the last few years, it's the team that actually discovered that comet about to hit Jupiter, which has done it. Gene and Caroline Shoemaker must be real masochists, because they spend the whole of the northern winter and then the spring searching the skies with telescopes in North America, and then they leave behind their summer up north and they come down to Australia to spend our winter here, so they get two winters every year. Most people like me try and do it the other way around. But they spend the winters down here, and they have a four-wheel drive, which indeed is actually housed normally here in Melbourne. And they go driving around the outback, looking at craters, measuring them and trying to decide, well, are they really an impact crater or not? And they've been very successful. That was one of the reasons for why we know those craters. We've looked for them in different places. Secondly, you need relatively inert geology. Okay, there may have been an earthquake in Newcastle a couple of years ago, but nevertheless, we get very few earthquakes or volcanic eruptions here in Australia. So it's a good place to look for craters. The same applies to the two other regions where we see those big areas with lots and lots of craters. The third thing which is significant is weathering. Do you get very much weathering? And you see the craters in Australia, and you'll see they're mostly in arid regions. So they get very little weathering in those sorts of places to erode them away. And again, the same sort of thing applies to many of the regions up in Canada in particular, where they're not eroded away for a different reason. They're just frozen solid a lot of the time. Okay, the other reason why it's easier to spot craters in certain areas is that a crater in the Gibson Desert is relatively straightforward to find. Lightning never strikes twice. It's a cartoon by every scientist's favorite cartoonist, Gary Larson. Two people here sitting, you're kidding, I was struck twice by lightning too. People kind of have this idea in their heads that because we've been hit only in the past, they think that we are safe from these things in the future. Well, look, I've mentioned to you there are 19 impact craters in Australia. And I showed you Goss's Bluff. I said it was 143 million years ago. I also showed you Wolf Creek, and I forgot to tell you, I think it's 300,000 years old. So you can kind of make yourself happy and think, well, that was a long, long time ago. It's not going to happen again soon. Out of those 19, four are less than 6,000 years old. Okay, now you're coming down now to a time scale which is like the human lifetime. On top of that, I'm absolutely convinced that there are probably hundreds more which are yet to be discovered, which are of similar ages. In fact, if I show you a plot here, diameter against age for terrestrial impact craters from the last 25 million years. Look, you can see it's heavily populated down here, but there's very few across this way. The only old craters, the ones with big ages across here, ages in millions of years, are the biggest ones. That is, if a crater is to survive for millions of years, it's got to be big. The small ones are eroded away very, very quickly. So we only see this dense population here, but in reality, it should continue all the way across the bottom. But all the ones which would be here across the bottom, these heaps and heaps of relatively small craters, have been eroded away. So again, we've been fooling ourselves into thinking that we don't get hit by these things very often, and that is absolute bunk. We do. But the evidence quickly gets eroded away, even if a crater is formed. And a more worrying thing, as I'm now going to show you, is that in fact very rarely is a crater formed at all. The last time we were hit by something big was in 1908, when a lump of rock about 50 or 60 meters across blew up in the atmosphere above Siberia. It blew up at an altitude of between 6 and 10 kilometers. It didn't get anywhere near the ground. Nevertheless, it blasted flat 2,000 square kilometers of forest. And the fall region, you can see up in the top right there, is considerably bigger than Washington, D.C., or New York City, or indeed Melbourne, if we wanted to put it on that plot. The other thing which is shown there, which is the strong indicator of what actually happened, is that the trees shown in the top right plot are all fell over radially away from the center. It's a blast, kablam, shot them outwards. On top of that, in fact, if you go there and you take a look, you'll find that those trees are all charred on one side only. They are not burnt through. They are charred on one side only. So you could scratch your head and say, well, how could that be true? What actually happened was the lump of rock came in and it blew up, and there was a huge radiative flux, much brighter than the sun. It dried out the trees and ignited them on one side, just like you struck a match. But then the match got blew out straight away. It got blew out by the shock, the blast wave, which came through 30 seconds or maybe a few minutes later. So they were ignited on one side only, and before they had time to totally incinerate themselves, the whole thing was blown out and the trees were flattened. And you might think we know lots and lots about this, but look, the first scientific expedition of any note at all went in there 20 years later, when a lot of it was overgrown. There are still scientific expeditions going in because we need to learn more from this. If such a thing as that happened above a city, that city's had it. Okay? It isn't a matter of it causing some damage. The city would just be almost disappeared. Now, how often do such things happen? Well, if I draw you a plot of how often they happen, it looks like this. The first one I've got there is the annual event. That is the thing we can expect to happen once every year. I'll come back to that in just a second. Then I've got the Tunguska event, this thing in Siberia I just showed you the picture of. They actually happen, according to our best estimates, once every 50 to 100 years. Now, you could say, well, look, 1908 is more than 50 years ago. Aren't we overdue for one? Well, look, they're randomly occurring events, and I would be dishonest if I was to say that we are overdue for one. They're not like buses. They don't come along according to timetables. Okay? We might not see one for another 200 years, and then we might get three within a week. That's the way they occur. However, the length of time we've been waiting since the last one does appear to be longer than the average waiting time. The next one I've got down towards the bottom here is a 1 kilometer impactor. Okay, that occurs once every 100,000 years. And 1 kilometer is a good little size to think about because that is the limit at which one gets global effects. Something like the Tunguska one, 50 or 60 or 100 meters in size, only causes local damage. That local damage might mean that a country the size of the Netherlands, plus Belgium, plus Luxembourg, plus part of northern France, actually gets obliterated, but that's only a local effect. Okay? Global effects are when everybody is in the soup, and that threshold is at 1 kilometer. That's once every 100,000 years. That's an important thing to remember. We'll come back to that in a while. The last one I've got down at the bottom is the KT event, the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction, which was when the dinosaurs died. That's about a once every 50 to 100 million year event, according to our best estimates, and we could be grossly wrong. Now, coming back to the annual event, you find that it's actually around about a 10-meter-sized object, and it is equivalent to an explosion of about 50 kilotons, which is five times the Hiroshima bomb back in 1945. And you could say, well, I haven't seen one of those lately. Well, look, on February the 1st, an object about 20 meters across entered the atmosphere above the Western Pacific. It was an explosion equivalent to, according to our estimates, about 100 kilotons, which is 10 times the Hiroshima bomb. Night became day for a short instant. It was seen by two fishermen, six US spy satellites. Okay? The point is, they do happen. If one looks at the spy satellite data, which covers the whole of the face of the Earth, we do see these explosions occurring. We're not conscious of them because most likely they're over the ocean or they're over an unpopulated region. If it occurs above the Gibson Desert, it isn't in the age the next day. Okay? Okay, how would we actually tackle these things? I'm coming towards the end. Back in 1979, an appalling movie was released called Meteor. And it shows these things going whizzing up to blast this object as it comes in towards the Earth. That is not the way to deal with this. Okay? All that does, even if we could do it, is it turns a cannonball into a shotgun blast. You still get hit by all the things. That is not the way to do it. Another way of thinking about that, which is epitomized in the following cartoon, is Fred's quick reflexes save the sausage rolls. I don't think I need to say anything more about that, okay? The way we need to do it is actually summed up in yet another cartoon. Here we are, the BC column. They're saying here, nature is so incredibly ordered, yes, so delicately balanced. And there's an important thing, delicately balanced. You don't need to upset nature very much and you're really stuffed. It goes on to say, a place for everything and everything in its place, yes, so predictable, as the asteroid comes zipping in behind them. This is what we've got to do. Note the term predictable. We need to be able to predict these things well ahead of time so that we can actually tackle them. And we've actually started trying to at least formulate a plan in order to do that. That plan was presented last year to the US Congress. It's called the Space Guard Survey. This was a NASA international committee comprising of 18 Americans. There were 6 people from overseas, 2 of us from Australia. That tells you that Australia is number 2 in this sphere of endeavor in the whole of the world. And that is definitely the case. There are only 4 search programs currently being carried out for the objects which can cause devastation on the Earth. 3 are in the United States, and there's ours in Australia. We have the whole of the Southern Hemisphere to cover, except for we can't do it. We're covering about 1/1000th of the area of the southern sky. That's all we can do with the present minimal funding which we've got, and the sort of program we're able to actually carry out at the present time.